believers in Maryland. Richard lives not far from Maryland. He's down in Virginia and right now working with the Department of Justice along with completing his last year of law school. And his position with justice is not a insignificant one. He's cleared for top secret clearance. And when I went to pick him up in downtown Washington today for our drive up here, he was delayed because he was on the phone talking to our embassy in Mexico. So he will have some interesting insights for us this evening as we pursue a series of meetings I have not ever done before for American Cassette Ministries. And thank the Lord for American Cassette. They're a real force multiplier in our world, and they enable people to get to meetings like this who maybe otherwise couldn't be here. They do so by the medium of the tapes. And the topic for this weekend series, as I say, brand new. I've never done it before, so you folk are the guinea pigs. But I think it's a good topic. It's one we should have done long ago. It's entitled Back to Jesus. It's time we got back to Jesus, isn't it? You know, we have a lot to say. God's last church on earth has a lot to say to the world. A lot of imposing messages, a lot of unique messages that have never before been given in the history of Christianity, nor could have been, because we hadn't caught up with prophecy yet until the end times arrived. And now God's last church has messages to give to the world, end time messages and end time warnings. You think about the world in which we live today, and it's very easy to see how our world could, in the face of incremental and increasing challenges, kind of revert. Human beings tend, in the face of danger, in the face of challenge or terror, to revert to an almost primal herding instinct. Anybody here ever worked with horses or cattle? All right, well, we have a horse ranch out in California. And all you have to do to get all the horses to come is to grab the dominant mare or the dominant horse in the herd, lead him or her, and all the rest of them come along. It's a herding instinct. And people are very similar to that, aren't they? When you face challenge or danger, you tend to want to herd, you tend to want to clump together, get strength in numbers, and there's nothing wrong with that as long as the people in that group make the right decisions. Now, in constitutional law, we call that a temporary majority. Frightened people can form a temporary majority, and they're brought together because of a common element like fear, and they say, we're facing a problem, we have to fix the problem, and if they're not very, very careful, they can wind up fixing the problem by whittling away constitutional rights. And that's the challenge a great nation like ours faces. Because our Constitution is the most precious thing we face and we have in this country, and to give it away in the face of danger is in many respects to surrender to those who would destroy it. So God's last church has an end time warning to the world that when we're faced with that time of trouble Daniel described, the worst thing that had ever been seen in human history, don't make the mistake of surrendering liberty for the sake of hoping to return to the good life. Because if you give up liberty for the sake of security, you wind up with neither one. You're neither secure nor free. Well, that's one of our end time messages, isn't it? You find it right there in Revelation 13. Very clear end time message in Revelation 13 and 14 that God's church has to give to the world. A warning, don't make the mistake of surrendering liberty. Don't make the mistake of assuming that religion should be something we vote on and then enforce. Well, there's another message God's people have to give to the world, and it's one that is almost unique to Adventism. Almost nobody else gives it, and those who do give it, in part, really don't give the whole thing. And that is the rationale why the law of God is still important for people living at the end of time. And there are lots of people who will say it isn't relevant anymore. And sad to say, out in California, there are even Adventists who say that. But God's last church will keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus, won't they? That's what the Bible says. That's good enough for me. If the Bible isn't a good enough authority source, I don't know where else we're going to go. So God's people at the end of time explain to the world not only that the law of God is still relevant to the Christian experience, but they explain why. And the rationale behind that is kind of encapsulated in this thing called a day of worship. Now, tonight, you know, it's not easy necessarily for us to part company from our neighbors who live right down the street and who are wonderful Christian people and who will be going to church next Sunday and worship on a different day of the week and seem not to fit in with the rest of the Christian community. It is not particularly easy to do that, so why are we here tonight? And by the way, as long as we're here, Shabbat Shalom. Sabbath peace to you. Why are we here? We're here just because God's Word says so. That ought to be reason enough. Now, why is that important enough to make it a defining issue at the end of time? Just simply this. If God's intention and His rule can be changed by a created being, then who has just won the war? Lucifer has won the war. That was the issue that started the war. In wartime, if you're going to win the victory, you have to always remind yourself, why am I fighting? What got me into combat? And what is the issue that we have to face and decide? And if we finally, at the end of time, concede the issue to General Lucifer and say, well, you know, a created being can change a day of worship or a part of God's law or His standards for His people. We've conceded the war, and God's people explain to the world the rationale why the law of God is still important. It isn't easy tonight to differ from wonderful Christian neighbors whom we respect and like. But my friends, it is easier tonight than it will be a year from now, or if time should last 2 or 3 years from now. Because as pressure forces us into this funnel called the end of time, you're going to feel compression from frightened people who look around them and say, it isn't like it used to be. Let's find our way back out of this thing. Let's go back to the good life. One of the first things they'll probably conclude is it's time to get back to the Lord. Let's agree on a day of worship and let's have a moral nation once again. There's nothing wrong with having a moral nation, but you can't legislate it. It has to come from the inside out. So a lot of things we have to say to the world. We have a health message that can give us 11 extra years of life for those who bother to live it. Lots of things God's church has to say to an end-timed world, but let me tell you something, folks. Unless all of these truths center around Jesus, then they're just so much talk. That's all they are. Just words. And they soon become empty words, because if there's no Lord in them, there's no substance to them. So our topic this weekend is back to Jesus. And we're going to go back to the very heart and soul and core of Adventism, the Lord. I personally feel that that's what 1888 was all about. There's been lots said and done about 1888, and some wonderful scholarship has been done on it. I kind of tend to look at things simplistically, and I think that what happened was we needed to get Jesus back into a lot of other things that are by themselves very important, but without Him of no importance at all. So our topic this weekend is back to Jesus. And tomorrow we're going to cover topics like the faith of Jesus. You know, we use terms like this. At the end of time, God's people will keep the commandments and have the faith of Jesus. And many times it's easy to say a phrase like this, and we kind of look at each other and we nod piously and knowingly as if we had really said something, but maybe once in a while it would be nice to stop and define the term. What is the faith of Jesus? If it is something God's people will share in and experience, maybe it deserves more than just a passing reference in a sermon and then going on like we really had understood it. Our entire hour tomorrow in the worship service will be devoted to the faith of Jesus, what it's really like. In the afternoon, we have a topic called Jesus' Unanswered Prayer. And it's kind of strange to think about it. We many times pray earnestly for things, and sometimes the Lord comes back with a big immediate yes, and sometimes we wait a while. And sometimes the Lord answers no, doesn't He? And did you ever stop to think about it? Jesus prayed for something He still hasn't gotten. There's an unanswered prayer of Jesus. Tomorrow afternoon, we're going to go through Jesus' unanswered prayer. Then we're going to find out who holds the key to the answer. And when we stop and realize who holds the key to the answer to his unanswered prayer, it might make us pray more earnestly and pray differently. We might understand better why sometimes our prayers aren't answered. Finally, tomorrow afternoon, we're going to talk about Jesus' special gift to an end-time church. So a lot of very substantive stuff we're going to talk about this weekend. Important to people expecting to see the face of God. But tonight, let's go back to something so basic that if we don't get it, nothing else we say this weekend will matter. Let's go back to the very foundation that we have to build everything else on. And our topic tonight, our title is, He's Coming Soon. But within that topic, there is a subtitle. Out in Hollywood, they would call it the backstory, a sort of a companion plot that goes along on a parallel track with the main topic. And the backstory to this one is, not only is Jesus coming soon, but if He is coming soon, then we better do what? All right, now some of you are saying we better get ready. Excellent answer. It's a very general answer. Now let's kind of, you know, move the lens up to another level of magnification. Focus in on it. How can we assist ourselves getting ready? What's something we can do? We better get our priorities straight. If the Lord's coming soon, we better get our priorities straight. So let's begin this evening with some recent events we've all lived through. That if nothing else could wake us up and help us to straighten out our priorities, these would. These events we have just seen. And I brought along tonight a helper who can do that far better than I can. It's my son, Richard. Richard is a third-year law student down at Georgetown. He's on the dean's list there. He graduated from PUC with honors. He's now working for the Department of Justice as well as completing his law school training this year. He was, on the morning of September 11, living just a few blocks up Columbia Pike from the Pentagon. And Richard felt his apartment building begin to shake, and he looked out the window. And the skyline of Washington was suddenly obscured by a Boeing 757, and it missed him by 20 feet. And he's going to share with us now the events we've lived through and what they mean in terms of our priorities as Adventists.
And the Lord said, "For what shall it profit a man if he gain the entire world? And lose what? His soul." It was the height of empire, and the nation's military might protected trade routes that encircled the globe. Amazing economic prosperity protected by a shield of military power. But out in the tidal flats of Virginia, a small band of highly motivated men were about to change history. They were about to cause Great Britain its greatest and ultimately fatal defeat. At Yorktown, where he was trapped against the sea, General Sir Lord Cornwallis looked out at the Revolutionary Army and he did the math. And he realized he was going to have to surrender. But when he did, the general had not lost his sense of irony. As his army marched out of its fortified positions at Yorktown, his band played an odd little tune called "The World Turned Upside Down." 200-some years later, it was September 10, 2001. America was rich with prosperity and with peace. Our economy had globalized the world, depending in large part on a system of completely free transportation, which could move people and services anywhere in the world within a matter of hours. That transportation system, in turn, depended on Pax Americana, the great American peace, peace where we said, when we said, because we said so. And on the eastern seaboard of the United States on September 10, we enjoyed the good life. We enjoyed the prosperity, and we were sheltered, we were protected behind the wall of the United States military, the most powerful force history has ever seen. And yet within hours, all of that would literally come crashing down around our ankles in so much shadow and dust. The heart of our financial system would be either destroyed or shut down. Our transportation system would be immobilized. And the proud military on which we placed so much reliance would find itself attacked in its own headquarters building. And then we would see the world turn very suddenly upside down. I know, because I was there. The morning of September 11, I was looking east out of my window. I was on the telephone looking out towards the Chesapeake Bay, and I saw the whole panorama of Washington, D.C. spread out before me. The United States Capitol building, the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, beautiful deep blue sky of winter, but with a lingering warmth of a very pleasant summer. Picture perfect day in our nation's capital, and about 9 o'clock that morning, I had not yet heard that at 8:47 an airliner had flown into World Trade Tower 2. I was on the phone with a telemarketer, and I began to hear behind my building the sound of jet engines, which is somewhat unusual. Occasionally we'll hear Marine One coming by my apartment building. It's on its route, but this was obviously an airliner, a heavy airliner. As I heard those engine sounds increase, the thought that went through my mind was that we had an airliner in distress flying back to Reagan National, which is just down the hill from my apartment building. The noise got louder and louder. I dropped the phone, ran to the window, felt the whole building begin to shake, and then looked up as Flight 77 literally filled my entire window, dropped down in front of my window, took the top out of a tree which grows up in front of it, banked slightly left as though it was heading for our Capitol building, and then made an abrupt, controlled right turn and dove into the western wall of the Pentagon. And as I saw that airliner disappear behind the line of trees, which hides the Pentagon from my view, it was obvious to me, without having heard about New York, that our nation was under some type of terrorist attack. It was very obvious it was a commercial airliner. It was very obvious it had been hijacked. And at that moment, as I headed out the door and started running down 7 flights of stairs to go down Columbia Pike to join in the rescue effort at the Pentagon, I realized our world had turned upside down. As I headed down the hill and the Pentagon began to come into view, I looked up. I looked into the sky, which had suddenly grown eerily quiet. And I asked the Marine I was jogging with, I said, "Where's our air cover? Where are the F-16s? And he said, "We don't have any. The only thing we have at this point is helicopters." And sure enough, coming from Andrews Air Force Base, which is just across on the other side of the district, I could begin to see SH and MH-60 Blackhawks lifting off and coming over to try to help with rescue efforts. For 40 minutes, we waited, because our military was not prepared to protect from that type of an attack. The great American peace, Pax Americana, we enforced it everywhere in the world but here, because we thought we were invulnerable to attack. About 20 minutes after we arrived on scene and started going down the hallways of the Pentagon, pulling people out of their offices, taking them to exit, some of them rather badly injured and burned, I heard a Pentagon security vehicle pull up outside, get on the bullhorn, and say, "We have to get everybody evacuated now. If you can move, get back to Henderson Hall. We have another airliner inbound at 20 miles. And at that point, our nation's capital, was wide open to further attack. Well, we ran up the hill, and as we were heading up the hill, a fairly large group I saw this fellow going against the grain. He was coming down the hill, a press reporter with his camera and his press badge. And he looked at me and he said, "Is the Pentagon that way?" And I said, "Yes, sir, it is. But if you'd rather report the news, if you'd prefer to report the news rather than make it, I suggest you stay here for the next few minutes." He did, fortunately, what I suggested. A few minutes later, the all-clear was sounded, and we went back in. And then about 40 minutes after the attack, I saw what still stands out in my mind as the most extraordinary sight I have ever seen and expect ever to see. And it was not the sight of Flight 77 coming over my head. It was the sight of an F-16 Fighting Falcon far off, just almost on the horizon over RFK Stadium at the far side of the district, right down in the weeds, low and slow, doing a radar sweep all the way around the district, looking for low-flying aircraft. And after it had sanitized the airspace 40 miles in every direction, that beautiful little fighter wrapped itself around and headed straight for the Pentagon. Picked up flaps, kicked in burner, came over, dipped a wing in a salute to fallen comrades, right over the damaged section, and then pulled up in a chandelle. The troops cheering. It was a fabulous moment. It was a moment when, at last, we could feel safe again. A few months later, having seen our transportation system and our military attacked or crippled by the 11th, I went north to New York. And I stood at ground zero. And as I did so, it was with something of a sense of irony, because just as around the time of the 11th, all of the second-year law students at Georgetown had been interviewing with law firms. Many of us were interviewing up in New York, some of us with firms which were based out of the World Trade Center towers. And I knew many of my classmates who, quite honestly, would have sold their souls to get into that building. You see, you didn't get in the World Trade Center if you weren't the very brightest and the very best. And as I stood there at ground zero and saw the sight of such a national tragedy and so much national sorrow, you really couldn't, you couldn't tell what had happened. It looked a lot like a construction site. By the first of this year, the recovery operations had proceeded to the point where the site looked fairly sanitary until you looked up. You looked up and these little gnarled trees around an old church in downtown Manhattan, lower Manhattan, and in those branches were wads of paper and letterhead, parts of files, parts of clothing, sweaters, shirts. Nobody had thought to clean that up. And it stood against the New York skyline as the last monument to the memory of the 3,000 people that died there that day. And as I looked at that, I had to ask myself, as those people jumped from the 105th floor, trying to escape the searing flames of JP4, what were they thinking? And was the price they paid to be in that building, to be the best of the best and the brightest, was it really worth it? And as I thought back to the 11th and to my own life and the career choices I was making, I had to answer no. Because I was there on the day the world turned upside down.
Thank you, Richard. He's told us two stories, accounts of events we've all lived through. We're all very close to all of these things. You're very close to both New York and Washington here. And between those two stories that Richard told, there is a common theme. There's a common thread. There's a common issue that runs through both of them. And my friends, if we don't get that, we have very little else to say to the world. So our assignment tonight is, what is the common denominator? What do you find in New York, in Pennsylvania, in Washington, in the events we've lived through? And while we're thinking about that, let's open the Word. I invite you to turn to Matthew chapter 24. Now, while you're finding Matthew chapter 24, let me just kind of do a little stage setting here so we have a picture in our minds of what's going on as we read these words in this remarkable book and chapter in the first gospel. What happened in Matthew 24 was probably occurring either very, very early April or very late May of A.D. 31. And one spring day, Jesus and his disciples had for some reason gone up to the temple. And they had been there, and they were walking out of the temple, and to walk out of the temple in A.D. 31 was an experience all its own, because you went from the top of Mount Zion, where that gorgeous sanctuary building was, with its gold leaf and its pristine alabaster-colored marble, and the green grape leaves twining around the twin pillars. You went from there down a series of stairs. This was the court of Israel, right? Below the court of the priests. And you'd walk down a flight of just alabaster, snowy white marble stairs, and come down to the court of the women. And as the temple went kind of down the slopes of Mount Zion, it did so in a cascading series of terraces and stairways. And from the court of the women, you would then go down to the court of the Gentiles on another row of stairs. And all around this thing were these gorgeous porches. Now, you remember in the book of Acts, there was a lame man who had been lame from birth, and he was lying in the porch of the temple. Well, people would go there because it was shady, it was fairly comfortable, it was cool in the summertime, probably a little bit warmer in the wintertime. So in these colonnaded porches, people would gather, and here's where Jesus and his disciples were walking. And the porches themselves were enclosed by roof structures supported by marble pillars almost 40 feet high. So it's a gorgeous building, the best that Rome could build. And as the disciples and Jesus were walking by, here are 12 young Jewish guys, all of them very young, very proud, very nationalistic. They love their faith, they love their country. And in today's Yiddish vernacular, so to speak, you can almost hear these young fellows turn to Jesus and point to the stones and say, so look, Lord, you know? And what did Jesus say? He turns back to his disciples and he says, don't look at those stones, fellows. Don't look at those twin towers at the foot of Manhattan. Don't put your trust in them, because they're not going to be there very long. Well, you can almost hear the air coming out of the balloons of those 12 young Jewish fellows, because they love their faith, they love their country, and they didn't quite know what to make of this. You know, this is coming down, and it's obvious in their minds, they had got to thinking, if the Lord is predicting the destruction of this, not one stone left on top of another, that has to be the end of the world. By the time the little group had made their way out through the narrow streets of Jerusalem and out the Eastern Gate and across the Kidron Creek and up onto the slopes of the Mount of Olives, the disciples had put it together. Jesus is predicting the end of the world, and they had a very logical question that you and I would also ask if we were in their position. We ask it today. And the question is, Lord, if the world's going to end, how are we going to know when it's happening? What will it look like? Very logical, very predictable question. So they got to the slopes of the Mount of Olives, and four of them got curious enough, they kind of got off to the side with Jesus, and Peter and Andrew and James and John said, Lord, what will it look like? How will we know when your coming is near, when the end of the world is about to happen? Okay, that's the background for Matthew 24. So the rest of that chapter now is Jesus' response to that very logical, very human question. And we look at verse 4. Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. Verse 6, and ye shall hear of what? Wars and rumors of wars. Now, there are people who sometimes say you can't believe a prophet because he or she plagiarized. Well, let me tell you something. That sounds like it was plagiarized from the New York Times of September 19. Wars and rumors of wars. Now, do you recognize the world in which you live? Right there. It's very clear to me tonight that this globe is spoiling for a scrap. They're spoiling for a brawl. We are headed for war. You can feel it coming. And it's going to happen in the Middle East. Unless a miracle occurs, we are going to be at war in the Middle East. And where that will end, I do not know, because we have the capacity of knocking over something that is so unstable, and what starts to roll downhill, nobody really knows where it will stop rolling. So, we could see ourselves back potentially in oil embargo situation and gas lines like some of us dreaded in the 1970s. We could see a destabilization of the Middle East. We could see Iraq break up into several constituent countries, thus having no counterbalance to Iran. We could see the religious extremists in Iran threaten the rest of South and Southwest Asia. And from there on, it's anybody's guess where we're headed. Wars and rumors of war. The Lord said that will be one of the signs of His coming. I was reading an intelligence briefing just in the last few hours. I don't mean to depress you tonight. We're not going to dwell long on this. But if you knew what military analysts know tonight, you would not sleep nearly as comfortably as probably we otherwise would. It is now an almost foregone conclusion that within a very, very limited period of time, we will be within range of ballistic missiles owned by North Korea, by Iran, and if we don't intervene, probably by Iraq. North Korea, for example, is now testing the Taepodong missile, which they have hitherto fired into space to get away from the concern that it's a ballistic missile. The thing probably can reach the continental United States, at least the West Coast. The Chinese have them. Our world is getting increasingly dangerous. I was talking just a week ago with a military intelligence officer, lieutenant commander in the Navy, and we were comparing notes on our concerns for the fleet. You know, in today's military world, the fleet will be fighting very close to shore. It's called littoral warfare. And it means you get in very close. The Persian Gulf is not that big a lake, you know. You're within easy distance of shore either way in many of those choke points. The problem we face today is the technology that is being purchased by many of what we used to call third world countries comes out of the old Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was capable of supplying them with anti-ship missiles so accurate that as soon as the airplane lifted off, got off the ground, it could fire that missile. The missile would then take off, fly for many, many miles, home in on the fleet, and some of these missiles go up in the air way, way up high, maybe 60, 70 miles, then they come, turn around, come straight down. That's the Soviet AS-16 missile. There's almost no defense to the thing. It's coming at you vertically, hypersonic. Now, the problem that our fleet faces is that thing becomes dangerous as soon as, for example, the Iranian airplane carrying it lifts off from Shiraz Air Force Base in Iran. Now, our fleet commander on scene has to make a decision. The AWACS says we have an airplane in the air coming off Shiraz. Is it carrying an AS-16? If it is, the only hope you have to save that aircraft carrier is to shoot the airplane down before it fires. To do that, you have to invade a sovereign airspace of another nation. And you've automatically committed an act of war. Those are the challenges our military faces today. Jesus says, you will hear of wars and rumors of war. And Ellen White goes on to say that in the closing moments of this earth's history, war will rage. But not only does he talk about a world in which there's military instability, he talks about natural calamities, doesn't he? Let's move on down here in Matthew 24 and look at verse 7. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes. Now, you know, just to complete the good news for this evening, nature now seems to become deranged and deliver us up what we out in California fondly look for, that's earthquakes. You don't have those back here, do you? Well, out in California, just a few miles west of Bakersfield where I live, there's a little town called Parkfield. It's right on the San Andreas Fault. The town is on the fault. I guess Main Street goes, you know, the right side of the street is on one side of the fault, the left side of the street's on the other. They have a water tower there painted in bold letters, Parkfield, USA, be here when it happens. Now, you understand why Californians just, you got to be a little nutty to live out there. So we have earthquakes, famines, and pestilences. What about famines? I was doing a little research recently, and they tell me that something close to 2 billion people every night go to bed hungry in this world. Kind of hard for us to imagine in the kind of plenty we enjoy. But 2 billion people don't get all the food they need. In southern Africa tonight, there are millions that are on the brink of starvation. And the same thing's happening in Central America, where they had some crop failures, and so the poor farmers whose crops fail sit by the side of the road, while the wealthy, who can still buy imported food, drive by. Now, what did Jesus say? There shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places, which means that we can expect to see natural calamities. All right? That's Matthew 24, verse 7. But not only does the Lord predict international conflict and natural calamities, he moves on to talk about something that gets kind of close and personal. And we're ready for verses 9 and 10. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. It's kind of an ugly picture, but the Lord painted it for us, so I guess maybe we are obligated to at least listen to what he has to say, aren't we? And in Mark 13, he talks about family, kinsfolk, brothers, and friends betraying each other. This is obviously a problem not necessarily between angry neighbors, but between angry fellow believers. Betrayed. Now, I don't want to dwell on this a lot because it can get kind of depressing, but my theory is if we're facing a future in which some of these threats are out there, it's far easier if we encounter that future having first of all talked about it and seen it in prophecy. Then when you get there, you're not surprised by it. You say, okay, this is tough, but I remember where I read it first. Therefore, it's happening just the way prophecy said it was supposed to happen. Therefore, I know the end of the story, and the end is not a bad one, it's a good one. But in the book Maranatha, we are told that toward the end of time, when God's people are called before legislative committees or courts or other bodies to answer for their faith, particularly in the courtroom, they will confront opponents. And guess who those opponents are? They are former believers. There's the challenge. And she goes on to say that men of talent and pleasing address, who once rejoiced in the truth but weren't sanctified through obedience, abandon God's people and join the ranks of the opposition. And then they become the most effective agents to misrepresent and condemn God's people in the courtroom. They become the expert witnesses for the prosecution. Now, I bring that up tonight only to say that once again, if heaven forbid that should happen to us, or happen to some of you folk, you find yourself in court on an issue of your faith, and the expert witness for the state, for the prosecution, is an ex-Adventist you once knew, don't get discouraged. Say, praise the Lord, it's happening just the way he foresaw, and if he could foresee it, he can get me through this thing. Okay, that's the purpose for studying prophecy, so when these things happen, we're prepared for it and better able to handle these things. All right, now let's begin to kind of put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together. Richard gave us a view from his perspective of what it was like to see our military challenged, our thoughts of invincibility shattered, and our financial system in New York left hanging in the trees. Jesus paints a picture here of wars and rumors of wars, of natural calamities, of even nature no longer really behaving predictably, of family and friends betraying those with whom they had once worshipped. Are you beginning to see a common denominator here? Do you see a common theme? What's happening as human history nears its end? Anybody have a hunch? Anybody have a clue? You see the common element here. Do you see that piece by piece in the economy, in our sense of security, even in friendly old nature, which isn't friendly anymore and it doesn't rain anymore on the East Middle Eastern states? Okay? Among our friends, some of whom prove to be perhaps less than reliable, the Lord is stripping away every way in which we can rely on this world. Am I making sense to you? Now, Daniel in Daniel 12 says, "And at that time shall Michael, the great prince, stand up, which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation." All right, it's kind of a gloomy picture, but notice how the verse ends, "And everyone, you know, that calls upon the name of the Lord will be delivered." What Daniel is describing is a world in which, bit by bit, all of the handholds we have to hang on to this world, to hang on to it, to be distracted by it, are stripped away. And when everything else goes, when we are stripped away from everything we used to hang on to in this world, the Pentagon, the World Trade Center, peace, the world of nature, even friendship in some instances, what do we have left? Exactly. Strip away this world and all the things we used to hang on to, and the only thing you've got left is Jesus. And that's the point, I think, at which Jesus can begin to recognize his people. You see what's happening to us? Even post 9/11 out in California, church after church I can visit and many times not hear a hint of an end time message or end time urgency. Now thank the Lord the East Coast hadn't caught up with us out West, right? Sometimes I've even distracted out there by so much noise I couldn't think about the end times if I wanted to. Unless perhaps I thought they had arrived. So the Lord is in His mercy trying to get our attention, you know, away from the widescreen TV and the luxuries we enjoy and all the distractions of this world. And He says, if I have to, I will peel away everything so that this world doesn't distract us anymore and we can see the real realities of heaven. It has been said that if you give a child a quarter and he puts it up in front of his eye, it will completely eclipse a Rolls Royce standing a few feet away. That's what we're doing in this world. Now, Richard read a text as he began that is maybe a good place for us to conclude as we end this evening. There's lots of things in this world that would distract us, even as we try to adjust to the strange new normal we find in our country, and we hate to see our country suffering the way we have. Nonetheless, it's very, very easy to try to go back to the world and try to snatch some normality out of it and say we're going back to the good life, when the Word of God makes it very clear, you know, that sooner or later this world is going to collide with an event called the coming of Jesus, and there won't be any of this stuff left for us. And the Lord in His mercy says, while there is still time, let's get our priorities straight. Let's go back to the Word. Let's go back to things that matter. Let's look intelligently at prophecy and world events, as we've tried to do briefly this evening. But when we've done that, let's just recognize it's all coming apart, and the only thing we have left is Jesus. Back to Jesus. That's our theme for this weekend. And He put it more eloquently than anybody could ever hope to. What shall it profit a man, or woman, or youngster, if they gain the whole world that's coming apart and lose their own soul? Thank you. Good.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel to reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations or for a free catalog, please call toll free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.